Hi, my name's Yanni. I'm an Aboriginal peer support worker at Headspace Adelaide. I'd like to acknowledge that the land we operate from and are meeting on right now is the land of the Kaurna people. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present and future, and acknowledge Headspace's commitment to making a positive contribution to young people who are Aboriginal.
Welcome back to the Headspace Sessions podcast. My name is Claire. I'm from the Community Engagement Team at Headspace Adelaide, and I'm joined by the lovely...
I'm Kat. I am from Headspace Onkaparinga. I'm usually this content developer, scriptwriter person, but today I'm the guest.
Thank you. It's so nice to have you on board.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm Natalie Veal, clinical psychologist from Celasta.
I'm so excited to have you here today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. So today we're having a chat about disability and mental health and the complexities that come with being possibly a disabled person and the journey you might have with your mental health along with that. So what does it mean to be disabled?
Well, commonly it's referred to those with long-term physical, mental, sensory, neurological or intellectual impairments, which restricts everyday activities. You look at the statistics, around 1 in 6 people in Australia have a disability.
I don't know. I think that's probably the very formal definition, I guess.
Absolutely. Statistics involved.
Yeah. but I guess for a lot of people, it's sort of a part of their identity. And yeah, of course it comes with maybe a diagnosis or some sort of impairment. It can kind of include some mental illness stuff if that's kind of a long-term thing, or yeah, obviously physical things or chronic illness as well. Mm-hmm. Some of those people classify themselves as disabled as well. So yeah, I don't know, I guess it's a very individual thing as well.
Yeah, it's about what's going on for you yourself and I guess what counts. It's a horrible,
it's sort of,
I use quotations for saying
what does it mean? It kind of depends so much on the person and what they're, and also their experience of the world.
Mm-hmm.
As in if you live in a world that's built for wheelchairs,
mm-hmm.
are you disabled with being in a wheelchair, or are you not disabled at all because you can access everything,
mm-hmm.
versus being in a world that isn't designed for wheelchairs, then you maybe are disabled by your environment, kind of social model, mm-hmm. vibes, as they call it.
Yeah.
If there's stairs everywhere, then that makes it inaccessible, then you're more sort of impaired by what your disability is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's going on around the world.
Yeah.
World around you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I talk a lot with my clients about invisible disability.
Mm.
So psychologists work with autism spectrum disorders or learning difficulties, and we talk about their experiences. You might not see them walking down the street and go, oh, that person has a disability. Mm. It's not as obvious with the wheelchair or some of the physical ailments. Mm. So that's another challenge.
Yeah, no, I think the whole invisible disabilities versus visible ones, there's kind of advantages and disadvantages to being either of those things.
Yeah.
And I guess for me, sometimes I look visibly disabled because the mobility aids I use. Sometimes I don't look disabled and it's invisible. And it's interesting some of the different experiences you can have with people assuming certain things or not wanting to give you accommodations because you don't look a certain way, or treating you super differently because as soon as you look a different way.
Mm.
Yeah.
How often do mental illness and disabilities, I guess, occur together? Natalie, I guess I'll throw to you for that one.
Well, the psychologist in me has brought more statistics.
Let's look
at
it.
The National Health Survey data. Mm-hmm. So 42% of people with severe or profound disability and 33% of people with other forms of disability self-reported anxiety-related problems in the 2017-2018 survey.
Mm-hmm.
This compares with 12% of people without disability.
Wow.
So that's straight away telling us there's an imbalance there. An estimated 36% of people with severe or profound disability self-reported that they had a mood or an affective disorder such as depression, compared with 32% of people with other forms of disability. And 8.7% of people without disability.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there's a big difference there in terms of experience.
Mm-hmm. And do we think that translates to young people as well then? I guess with that data, of course, it's across the whole population, but definitely specific to young people.
Absolutely. Young people have added challenges. So in their time of life, they may experience social isolation. Mm-hmm. There might be lack of employment or education pathways available to them, mm-hmm. or financial challenges and experiences of discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're in a school setting, there might be some segregation and bullying experiences, which impacts mental health.
Yeah. Do you mind sharing a little bit about, I guess, yourself and your experience?
Yeah. So I have had mental health issues for like a long time, and that's, I'm not going to mention specific things just because I think for me it's like my disability is the combination of all these different things,
mm-hmm.
and there's not really a point in me going, I have this diagnosis and this diagnosis and this diagnosis. Mm. But I've had mental health stuff for a long time. That's part of my disability. I also have like chronic illness stuff that causes like pain and fatigue and like dizziness, things like that. And like, I think that's pretty much it really. I just have that combo of like chronic illnessy physical stuff and also sort of lots of different mental health things as well. And I use the NDIS, and that's been a really great thing for me. And that was kind of interesting too. Like that was a big part of me sort of suddenly identifying as disabled and like coming to the realization that maybe that was something that like I could be, or that's something I could find community in as well. But yeah, I don't know, it affects all different things. Like, yeah, obviously with the fatigue stuff, sometimes I'm just too tired to do basic things that I need to do. Or like hygiene stuff, sometimes with my mental health stuff, that can be really hard. Mm. Or like motivation kind of stuff. Yeah, sometimes I have to be in hospital, so that kind of interrupts things and things as well.
So along with some of those challenges, have you ever felt stigma or sort of any exclusion? You kind of touched on a little bit when you talked about the meaning of being disabled.
But yeah, it's interesting. Like sometimes the sometimes it can be very subtle and you're like, oh, is that about the disability? Is that about something else? I think what surprised me the most is the amount of stigma that can sometimes come from like medical professionals who maybe don't understand like my exact conditions or maybe don't. So that has been really interesting too, and like learning how to like advocate for myself in those situations when people are trying to discount things or when people try and focus too much on mental health and ignore the physical things like that. And then sometimes, I don't think it's anyone's fault, but sometimes with friends or acquaintances, sometimes it can just be a bit like, sometimes my disability can scare them off a bit or people don't know what to do or how to help. And so they're just like, oh, I won't invite you to this thing at all because I don't know how to like help, or I don't know what will happen if something happens or whatever.
Yeah.
So that can be tricky. And like everyone's always very open about it. And I've, with my closest friends, I've kind of talked about it more, and we've learned how to sort of have a plan and a backup plan and things like that. And it's much better now. But I know that definitely at the start of my disability is becoming more of an issue, or like more impairing or whatever the word is. Yeah, it was tricky for everyone to know, like, I've never heard of this before, or like, I've never seen you like this before, so I don't know what to do. I just might not do anything, or I might just not invite you at all, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's so much, I guess, like pre-thought you have to put into
Exactly. So much extra like planning and like I have to know what to do. Say if I get like a migraine, I have to know what to do. Or just, yeah, just that extra bit of thought. Or like even like accommodations, like today we're sitting at the table rather than the like couches, because the couches have really bright lights. Which doesn't work well for me. So it's like little things like that that sometimes are quite small, but you kind of have to think about it a little bit, and then it can make all the difference. But yeah.
Absolutely. So do you then find that that has a relationship to your mental health and some of the things you experience for that? Do you think they're related?
Yeah, I think it can be, it can feel very isolating to feel like you're sort of an odd one out all the time and that you have to have something different for you that's different to, like, especially when you're a teenager as well, like trying to like fit in and like just blend in underneath the crowd kind of thing. Yeah, I think there definitely is a relationship there. Between the two.
I guess, Natalie, a question for you then is, how can people with disability learn to cope with the challenges that might come along with it, and some things that Kat's kind of touched on?
Very good question. For me, firstly, it's understanding what is your baseline. So you walk into the psychology office, and I get different presentations at different times. You might be in a heightened crisis mode, or maybe you're in a good place. But for me to understand, so it's all personalised. If we look at coping, firstly, what are the areas that you have challenges in? How do I know, or how do you know if you're not okay, all right? And what are the signs? Who is in your team? Or, you know, who's your support network, and understanding what do we do or draw from those certain people, and we develop a plan.
Yeah.
I talk a lot about an emotional bank account with my clients, and we need to look at what are the deposits that bring you a sense of joy or wonder or grabs you in life? What depletes you of energy? What are the things that you do? So even going to appointments or the social commitments can both be a deposit and a withdrawal. And you know, the amount of planning you need to do, what, you know, it costs you emotionally and physically, and being aware of those moments. And then afterwards, what do I need to do to balance my account?
Yeah, I really like that. That's a cool idea. Yeah. I think one thing I found, especially with the chronic illness side of things, it's sort of been about learning what the new baseline is and like readjusting to being like, okay, this is the new normal. This is what it is now, and kind of trying to be accepting of that. And yeah, then trying to like work with what I've got to try and add in as many like good things as possible while still getting enough rest and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think some of the things that you talked about, Natalie, is kind of what you're doing already, Kat, with some of your friends and having those backup plans in place and some of that pre-planning done and communication with the people in your team so that you kind of set up for that success as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Communication is key. So at baseline, what are the words? How do I describe my experiences to others? And when we throw mental health in the mix, we might not have been in that headspace, and we might shut down and withdraw and do the all the opposites. So if you have your team and those around you that know, what are the signs and what's my vocabulary to share? That's really helpful.
We often talk about, especially at Headspace, some like common tips for a healthy headspace. And they are sort of things about, you know, keeping active and staying connected and some of the common things we talk about to keep a healthy headspace. How can people with a disability, I guess, take those on and make sure that they work for them without getting disheartened by the tips?
I guess it's baseline.
Yeah.
Okay. Maslow's hierarchy of needs and pinpointing, well, what do I need right now? And if we think about the pandemic we've experienced and how that's been a challenge with meeting daily things like going outside, going for walks, being socially connected and finding out what energizes you, I think it's important. I can say, yep, get some sunshine every day, drink your liter, 2 liters of water. What is it up to these days? I don't know. But if that doesn't resonate with you, doesn't energize you, you're not going to do it. So you've got to find it within yourself to name what's helpful. You know, look at the what is energizing to be helpful.
I think for me, I've sort of worked out that sometimes, like let's say the tip is like, I don't know, go outside for a walk or something. If I am way too exhausted to do that today, it's about kind of learning that it's not so black and white. Or like if it's like social connections, catch up with friends or whatever, it's not black and white. You don't have to catch up with them with like, for like 3 hours. You could like see them for half an hour or like talk on the phone or like, and I think COVID's been nice for that in a way because it's taught us a bit more about using like technology to connect and things like that, which I think has been a really big thing for like the disabled community as well, like sort of that whole space opening up a bit more and being more accepted instead of mainstream. But yeah,
I guess along those lines of learning what tips work for you and having those good support networks in place, and we talked about having your communication style, things that work for you. How can communicating boundaries and needs for disability be helpful?
I don't know, that's something that's been a really big like learning thing for me is like how you talk about your experiences, how you communicate those experiences just makes all the difference. And sometimes working out exactly what you need and like how you can communicate that or like what you need from someone else or just what you, how to describe what you're experiencing so that it sort of makes sense. Because I think sometimes if you're coming from like a really emotional place, it can be like a scramble of words and just like it doesn't quite work. But if, I mean, sometimes having like a written thing I found is really good. Like if this happens, this is what I want you to do, or like just saying like, this is what this looks like, this is what I want you to do, or like, I don't want you to do anything, but this is just what it looks like and this is what I'll do for myself or something like that.
On the flip side, it's about, well, what happens if you don't communicate? What are the costs for you? And finding that reason to, and people with disabilities are at risk of burnout. So if you don't communicate what you need at a time, people can't mind read.
Yeah.
Right, can they? Yeah. Even as a psychologist, can't mind read. Go figure. And it's really important that your inner space to be okay with talking with others and your immediate network, number one, and even branching out and finding the way, the vocabulary that you're okay to share, what you need or not need, being assertive. I think that's tricky.
Oh, yeah, it's so tricky. That has definitely been a thing for me, just like learning that like the people that lose if I don't communicate properly is like not only me but everyone around me as well, because they feel like they wanted to help but they had no idea I needed anything. And then for me, I can lose out because I haven't communicated well, and so then I don't get to do all the things that I wanted to do, or I don't get to like have the experiences I wanted to have because I wasn't. I mean, it can feel quite personal talking about this stuff.
Absolutely.
But I think, yeah, just finding that place where you are comfortable and the words that you are comfortable using and things is really, yeah, really important.
Especially if you're an anxious sort of person too. Yeah. It can be really confronting to think about it. Like your suggestion, maybe I need to write down what I need to say or what are some talking points here, rehearsing it, talking with someone else, practicing it, and then doing it, and then seeing, you know, the benefits and what happens next.
Yeah. What if people don't have supports in place or people they can go to? How do you find that support network and how do you reach out?
I don't know. I guess there's like different areas. It depends what you need, I guess, in terms of what sort of support you need. But like there's always like organisations that can help, like i.e. Headspace, things like that.
Yeah.
Or there's like, I don't know, I think a lot of people find, especially with the disability community, like online spaces can be a really great place to kind of even just see yourself reflected in someone else and realise that it's not like a weird thing. It's not wrong. It's not, there's people around you, like, or like all around the world, even if they're not close in location to you, sort of having similar experiences instead of advocating and doing cool things. Even like accounts of people with disabilities who are, that the account isn't about disability, it's about something else. They're just out sort of doing their own thing. And just, I think, and I guess just speaking for myself, I find that very validating, knowing that it's sort of this community that I'm part of, even if I don't ever see those people like in person.
Yeah. Does it like help normalise your
I think it helps normalise it, because I think often it can feel, as we sort of said before, like very isolating and very like, oh, I'm the only one who's going through this. There's no one else, I don't know, my age who's going through this, or there's no one else in my friend group who's going through this. And then to just be able to like look online and see something reflected straight back can be really cool. Yeah.
That's really good.
So I talk to people about finding someone that you trust, that you feel comfortable talking to, and, you know, friends are great. However, they sometimes cannot take so much. You know, you're so aware of how much time that you can spend talking about this, and a lot of people might struggle and to know what to say, how do I show empathy? You know, people want to, like, problem solve and help you. Finding out support networks through the community and through channels that you know of who's helped you. If you wanted to connect with a psychologist, you might want to talk first with your GP and find out the avenues of a referral to a psychologist. Or for some people through the NDIS, they might be able to find a psychologist through that stream. Obviously, Sonder has lots of programs.
You have to get your personal plug in there.
And finding that right person who has understanding and experience working with your disability is really helpful, so that you feel understood, that you have that connection with someone to help you. And it might just be for a short amount of time, might be for an experience that you're going through, or it might be someone that you want to connect with over time, more long term.
Yeah, perfect. Kat, are you proud of your identity in being a disabled person? Like, how do you relate to that label, I guess?
It's been such a journey. I rejected it so much at first. It felt like it was a quote-unquote bad thing, or it was going to be this negative add-on to my identity. But I think the more that I sort of grow and think about it, it does make me proud. And it makes me proud, like, the sort of history of all the advocacy that's kind of come before, and the way that disabled people now have so many more sort of, well, they always had rights, but their rights are like fulfilled more than they used to be and stuff, which makes me super proud. nowadays it's like if I wasn't proud of being disabled, I couldn't really be proud of myself either. So I am now. Yeah. It's definitely a journey.
Do you have strengths that have kind of been highlighted through your journey of, I guess, finding connection with this label and, the, come from that?
I think actually, at first I thought the strength I would get from it was like resilience and like going through hard things and getting through them. But I think when I think about it more, it's more like the strength I've gained is actually knowing when to step back and knowing when to kind of not like admit defeat or like when to ask for help, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's actually what it's probably taught me the most is like when it's okay to not kind of act like everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think also like that strength in like, yeah, being brave enough or proud enough to just like be who you are in the world and things like asking for accommodations, like that can be really hard at first. So I think it's really, I've grown in that way too and like built on that strength of like, being assertive instead of standing standing my ground when I have to. Yeah.
Is there something then that you would want someone who's newly connecting with the label, or maybe even your younger self, that you would like, I guess, is the takeaway from all of this and your experience today?
I don't know. I think just to not be afraid of the disabled kind of label and don't be afraid of leaning into that community and learning more about what it all is and what it means and, yeah, I think just trying to accept more things about yourself and not like just instantly panic and be like, oh, my life is over because all this is happening or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Trying to draw on those communities that you're there and finding your place in all of it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
One last point, Kat, you said earlier, takeaway, inclusion and access is a fundamental human right. Mm. And what you said to me really resonated. What would happen if everywhere was wheelchair accessible, will that person still have a disability? And that's like a really interesting takeaway. I guess 1 in 6 Australians have a disability. How can we be more supportive and ensure that they have access and are included and their experiences are valued? That's a really interesting concept.
And I think it so is an important thing for us at Headspace Adelaide and all the Headspace centres is to have that. We try and have that experience, I guess, validated and try and remove as much of those boundaries as possible. And having people like Lovely Cat being a part of our volunteer career, I think really helps add that perspective. And we're so grateful to have you. And we're so grateful to have you, Natalie, in our wider family as well. Thank you so much for joining us today. If this episode has brought anything up for you, there will be some support in the description. And this is also the end of season 4. So thank you for coming along on the journey with us. And we look forward to having you join us soon.
Yeah.
Thank you.